We open up the new year with this new sermon series, and believe it or not, it's if you follow the traditional church calendar, it's still Christmas, and it's still the season of Christmas. Christmas is 12 days. It ends tomorrow with the day of Epiphany. So maybe you were wondering, hey, how come that decoration is still here? Like, isn't that just for Christmas? Well, it still is Christmas. It still is Epiphany, the day when the wise men came and laid their gifts before a young Jesus. We don't know how his exact age. He was young. They worshipped him. They laid their gifts before him. They traveled really far to find this king. And today we're going to kind of relook again at scriptures to see what it is that we know about or we believe about this king that we call Jesus. It's 2020. I thought it'd be a good day for a vision check. Maybe some of you've been with one of those. How many of you have had the privilege or honor of doing that? How many of you have done it like every year for the past as many years as you can count? How many of you, like me, can't remember the last time you've had to do one of these? All right, there's some of us. That's not the vision check that I want to talk about today. What I want to talk about is the vision of Jesus that we have to make sure we're seeing him properly, because I think life has a way of doing that to what we think of when we think of Jesus. Life has a way of making it blurry, making it not quite sure what it is we believe, or maybe we know what we believe, but maybe not really why we believe it, and so if it gets challenged, we don't really know how to dig deeper and keep the picture of Jesus fresh in our face. Maybe it's just we've been out of the Word so long, and we need to just get back into it. Whatever it is, we're going to spend the opening sermon series of 2020 checking our vision on the one we call Jesus, based out of the book of John. But before we get there, just to continue our eye test check, I haven't been to an eye doctor where I actually had I watched Ginger do it a couple times because I was curious, where the doctor puts these weird things on your face and then goes, better one, better two, and I'm sitting there just watching going, what is happening right now? This is bizarre. And the person gives an answer, well, better two, and then, okay, great, next one, better one, better two, and like this, there's a whole sequence of these things as they check your eyes. So here's my version of that when we talk about Jesus. All right, better one or better two? All right, which one do we like? Do we like that Jesus, this kind of stoic Jesus, or teaching Jesus on the side of the hill? We got some, maybe this Jesus. Who doesn't like the walking on water Jesus? How about Jesus lifting up? It looks like a man. He's lifting up there, potentially healing a blind person or doing something. But walking on water Jesus or the healer Jesus? Or maybe you're like Ricky Bobby and you like baby Jesus, little sweet baby Jesus. And that's the picture of Jesus you turn to more than anything. Or maybe it's the action Bible version of Jesus cleansing the temple that you turn to. Overturning tables with a whip in his hand, and he's kind of angry, and people are like, oh no! Or maybe it's the triumphant King Jesus ready to come and do war and shed blood, however you want to picture the version of him in Revelation. There's all these different kinds of versions. We have biblical texts for all of them, but how do we really see and understand Jesus? And why do we need to always get our vision checked, or why is it so important? Because just like our eyes deteriorate, our spiritual vision deteriorates. We need to constantly turn to God's Word to tell us what he is like, or we can quickly make Jesus into what we want and look more and more like ourselves. And if you don't know what that is, that's me acting as Jesus in the musical. Right? But we all do that. We all make Jesus look like ourselves instead of the goal, which is for us to look more and more like Jesus. That's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians, and we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed We're being transformed into the same image of the Lord, of Jesus, from one degree of glory to another. And you know what? Life has a way for doing this for us as well. See, we have these pictures, these ideas, these understandings of who Jesus is, who God is, how he'll respond, what he'll do in situations. Right? Until life shows up and an event happens, something that we don't like maybe. Maybe it's getting fired from a job. Maybe it's having to move and start in a new school, and you don't like that. Maybe you love that. Maybe it's experiencing divorce in the family. Maybe it's relational problems with a best friend. Maybe it's having to declare bankruptcy, and you tried an adventure, but it failed. Like, all these different things, they have a way of causing us to really respond in three main ways to whatever it is we believe God to be. We can either double down on it, and go, nope, absolutely, this is who God is. I don't care what happens. I'm standing firm on my belief. It might cause us to grow or to change a little bit and go, well, maybe that's who I thought God was, but I'm understanding things a little bit differently now. And you can talk to almost anyone who's walked in the Christian faith long enough, and they'll say, yeah, I've changed slightly in my beliefs or in my approaches. People ask me, do I ever repeat a sermon? I go, well, it depends how far back in the past it came from, because if it was from me as a 2013 pastor, it might need some work. Just being honest, I've grown a little bit, I've gained some wisdom. So no, I don't just pluck things out of the past and just redo them, because we kind of change a little, and life has a way of doing it. So we can double down, we can kind of change or grow, or sadly, sometimes people will just abandon it all together, right? Because their version of God didn't meet the situation they needed, and so they just turn their back on God for good. You go, well, you weren't there when I needed you, so why not? So what are some examples? Well, maybe it's a situation that causes you to question. Anyone ever hear that God is all good all the time? Anyone ever being willing to say that they've questioned how to properly understand that in light of something you maybe experienced or something you've seen on the news that you go, well, all good all the time? How do I reconcile that with this, right? Or maybe all powerful. Who's heard that God is all powerful? And have you ever wondered, like, well, if you're all powerful, then how come, and then just fill in the blank, how come this didn't happen? How come this wasn't stopped? How come this wasn't avoided? Why did we have to put up with Hitler? Like, fill in your blank, whatever you want. All I'm suggesting is that sometimes life causes us to have to really analyze not only what we believe, but why we believe it. There's a certain phrase that unfortunately many Christians would fall under, and it's, I've shared this before, I wanted to share it again, I meant to put it on the PowerPoint and I forgot to, so sorry, but it's this phrase called moralistic therapeutic deism, right? Moralistic therapeutic deism, and I would say probably all of us have believed this at one point, maybe some of us still are. Moralistic therapeutic deism. Deism simply means there is a God, right? Deity, deism, God. God exists. There is a God. Moralistic aspect of it is this belief that he is good, so I should do my best to be good as well, because that's what he expects of me. Therapeutic is, well, he's not overly involved in my life, but if I ever need him, I can turn to him and he'll be there. Right? That's moralistic therapeutic deism. And if you want to know the number one thing that's crippling the church in America, it's moralistic, therapeutic deism. The number one thing that I've come across when something bad happens in life that causes people to question who God is or the God that they've believed in, I've discovered that many times they've actually believed in moralistic, therapeutic deist and not really the God of the Bible, as he reveals himself to be. So, how do we make sure we're seeing 2020 when it comes to the God we serve? Well, we refresh our vision by his word, right? And or in the words of Alan Hirsch from Forge America, we re-Jesus ourselves over and over and over and over and over. We saturate ourselves with Jesus, with the Gospels. And that's exactly what we're going to do this morning and continue each week of this sermon series, Everything You Need. So if you have your Bibles, open up with me to the book of Exodus. We're going to start in Exodus, then we're going to make a jump to the book of John. We're going to be in Exodus, Exodus chapter 3. Exodus is one of the easiest books to find. It's number 2, Genesis, Exodus, Old Testament, chapter 3, early on. And we're going to see, how did God first reveal himself to Moses? How did he reveal himself to his people? What did he want them to know about him? And then what does that mean for us? All right? So, Exodus chapter 3, I'm actually going to begin in chapter 2, verse 23. And read to verse 14 of chapter 3. And we're going to see, what does God tell us that we need to know as we move forward and make sure our vision sees him correctly? Here's what it says. During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro. Quick history reminder here. Moses, Hebrew baby, put in the Nile, found by the Egyptian Pharaoh's daughter, raised in the palace, murdered an Egyptian, and then ran because he thought he was going to be punished, maybe even lose his own life. So he's out in the wilderness somewhere. So this is that Moses, right? All right. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you're standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He said, But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you've brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Then Moses said to God, If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, What is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, Say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. So I don't know about you, but at this point, I'm not sure I would be completely convinced to go toe-to-toe with the most powerful person on the face of the planet because some burning bush told me his name was I Am. Right? I mean, let's not get so lost in the familiarity of this story that we don't lose sight of the fact that what in the world is that supposed to do for Moses? First, he's told he's going to have a sign that's going to happen after what he's supposed to do occurs. So I don't know about you, but that's not overly comforting. So you're not going to give me a sign now. I have to wait till this ends, and then the sign's going to happen, right? Okay, so God's not really giving him any help there. And then he says, what's your name? And he says, I am. Okay, you are what? Like, what a peculiar phrase. We just sang a song, and I even said it's my favorite. It's one of my favorite songs. But we have to admit it's a bizarre phrase, I am that I am. Like, what does that mean? Why would that give Moses courage to go and do this? Right? A person raised in Pharaoh's house, now going to try to recruit and help the Israelites who would have known about him raised in Pharaoh's house. And now he's supposed to come and deliver them. And the name he's given is I am. God's self-revelation. I am that I am. Yahweh. The name Yahweh. Well, what we need to know, and what maybe some of us remember from a sermon earlier last year, is that this name has the connotation is I am that I am. I will be what I will be. But it's this name of promise that takes it one step further, that has this kind of feeling of I will be everything you need in the moment you need it. I am that I am, right? That's the promise. I will be everything you need in the moment that you need it. And if you remember, it's this name of promise given in response to the people being in slavery, right? Verse 7 and 8, he says it. I've surely seen the affliction of my people. I've heard their cry. I know their sufferings. And so I'm going to come and do something. I am that I am. I will be what you need me to be when you need it. And so the dialogue goes on a little further. You can read it for yourself. Eventually Moses goes, why don't you just send someone else? God flares up in anger and Moses goes, okay, never mind, I'll go. And so he goes. And with who knows how much assurance, but he goes. And he approaches Pharaoh, right? And what happens? Well, this God Yahweh who speaks out of the bush, who promises to be what you need me to be when you need it, shows himself to be a deliverer. If you read through more of Exodus, you'll read the account of how the plagues come and how Pharaoh is led to let the people go. So he does deliver them. But not right away, right? In fact, the first thing that happens is the people of Israel tell Moses to leave, that things are worse because of them. And even Moses goes to God, what? Things got worse. And he said, stand back and watch. Watch me be what you need me to be when you need it. So then he let go. But if you know the story, after Pharaoh lets the people go, he has a change of heart. And he chases after them when they're in the middle of the wilderness. And they're stuck up against the what we call the Red Sea, or the Sea of Reeds. And Yahweh shows himself not only to be a deliverer, but also a protector, because he splits the water so that they can go through on dry land. And when Pharaoh and his army enter the waters come crashing back down in, and he takes out the most powerful military force on the face of the earth at that point, without a single Israelite having to do anything about it except trust God and follow as he leads. So he shows himself not only to be a deliverer, but also to be a protector. But then he shows himself to be a provider, because they're walking around kind of wandering, and they get hungry, they get thirsty, and they're like, what are we going to do? And they come after Moses, and they complain, and they do all this. And in the midst of that, God says, watch me, I'll make water come out of the desert. I'll cause manna to fall on the ground, you'll have all the bread you can eat, and I'll even bring quail in. You'll have water, bread, and meat, as much as you need. You will all be fully satisfied. Right? But not so much that you get full but so that you're satisfied. Because I'm the God who will give you what you need when you need it. But not only that, he's a God who goes before. So we see he's a protector, he's a provider, he's a deliverer, but he also goes before. And you can read about this, how he goes as the fire of pillar at night, the cloud by day. Many times as the people are entering new places, God goes ahead of them as their defender, kind of using strange words like the bee and different ways of referring to it, but that's God going before, clearing things out so that his people can be safe. He's the God who will be what you need him to be when you need it. And here's what we need to know. One of the things we need to know this morning. He's these things regardless of what we are and how we act. Right? You got to know this. Because I think that's maybe the most important part of his name being I am that I am. Right? It wasn't I am that I am if you are what you are. That's never part of it. His self-proclaimed, self-revealed name is I am what I am. And what's proven, if you read throughout the whole rest of the Old Testament, is regardless of who we are or how we act. The people of Israel doubted when Moses first showed up. In fact, they told him to go home, but God still delivered them. After they were delivered, they questioned over and over and over, had multiple rebellions to try to throw Moses out of leadership. They made a golden image of some calf, of probably a god of Egypt, when Moses left for a couple days, and they all worshipped it and had this frenzied celebration thing around it. And like, really, a golden calf did all those things? Something you fashioned from your hands, but God didn't change who he was. They seemed to constantly complain. They rebelled against his direction. In the book of Judges, the people have become a total disgrace to everything that they're called to be. And yet God still continued to be a deliverer, a protector, and a provider. He continued to be what people needed when they needed it. The question, though, is how far is he willing to go? And what does some name revealed to Moses have to do with us in 2020? Right? What's it really have to do with us in America in 2020? What God revealed himself to some shepherd thousands of years ago in the deserts of the Middle East? Well, we have to ask ourselves, what's our biggest problem? Right? What is our biggest problem? Well, our world is broken, and so are we. That's what I would say our biggest problem is. And what's God's response to this problem? By being what we needed. Right? That's his response. By perfectly fulfilling Exodus chapter 3, verses 7 and 8, where he says, I've heard their affliction, I've seen, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them. I've seen their sufferings, I've heard their cries, and I have come down to deliver them. And maybe we think, oh, well, yeah, that happened in Exodus. And well, yeah, but it happens all throughout the Old Testament. God continues to come down until he comes down in a way nobody would ever have expected. And so I pick up in the book of John, chapter 8, where Jesus is in the midst of this discussion with Jewish people, mostly about Father Abraham and about what to follow and not follow and who he says he is, but who they say they are, and truth setting you free. And anyway, if you want to get the full context of it, read all of chapter 8 today. But we're going to just jump in verse 48. And it says this, the Jews answered him, are we not right in saying you are a Samaritan and have a demon? Right? He doesn't like what they're saying. So they're calling Jesus a demon, calling him a worker of the evil one. Okay? Jesus answered, I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. Yet I do not seek my own glory. There is one who seeks it, and he is the judge. Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death. The Jews said to him, now we know that you have a demon. Abraham died, as did the prophets. Yet you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death. Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died? And the prophets died? Who do you make yourself out to be? Jesus answered, if I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say he is our God. But you have not known him. I know him. If I were to say that I do not know him, I would be a liar like you. but I do know him, and I keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it and was glad. So the Jews said to him, you are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. So they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. God will be everything we need when we need it. The great I am. And what we see in this text is that includes becoming flesh himself. And that's exactly what he did. The great I am became flesh. The great I am walked among us. The great I am came down to deliver. And I'm getting this all out of verse 58 where Jesus says, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. Now maybe you're like, oh yeah, but I say I am too and different things. And well, yeah, but the phrase he uses is the exact same phrase that Yahweh himself uses when he speaks to Moses out of the burning bush. Right? It was a calculated word that Jesus used to make that statement. I am. He's claiming godhood. He's claiming of being equal with Yahweh. He's saying that being you worship that presented himself to Moses in the burning bush, that's me. And the people heard this loud and clear. They don't miss it for a second, the claim that he's making. How do we know this? Because of what they do. They pick up stones because they want to kill him, because they think he's guilty of utter blasphemy, because no person dares claim godhood or equality with Yahweh. It's strictly against anything within Judaism, punishable by death by stoning. And so that's what they do. They pick up the stones. They don't miss it. He's making the claim of being God. Unfortunately, their response is to reject him. Right? That's not something you do to somebody you're accepting. And if Jesus isn't God, then just throw Christianity out. Right? If Jesus was just another philosopher, theologian, then take him or leave him, really. Just what do you like about what he says and apply it to your life, and what don't you like about what he says, and who cares? If he's just another theologian, another sage, another wise man that came along. But if Jesus is our creator, come in the flesh, well, that changes everything. And here's some questions that we really need to get at this morning, and it's going to get real honest real quick. Right? We say God is everything you need, but is he everything you want? Right? God is everything you need, shows it in Scripture, he demonstrates it by coming in the flesh himself, and we can preach a whole year about this and make it crystal clear that he's everything you need, but is he everything you want? What's your motivation for coming to church on Sunday? To impress that person sitting next to you? To keep mom and dad off your back? To limit the nagging from your spouse? Like, in your heart of hearts, what's the real reason we even gather together as his people? For good music and hopefully a good message? Or can you say with Lecrae these words out of his song, More? Your goodness, your mercy, more. I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, more. Your love and your grace, more. I just need a taste, more. Your peace and your passion, more. Your joy and compassion, more. You've got it, I need it. More. I just gotta have it. Right? Is that what's in our heart of hearts when we gather on a Sunday morning, when we go to God in prayer, when we open up his word? God, I just want more of you. Is that what we long for? When we're singing praises, just saying, I hope you can hear me singing your praise, because you are so amazing and you're everything to me and I'm here to give you my all. I don't know. But it's something we need to really ask ourselves and really wrestle with as we think about our vision going into 2020. God, you may be everything I need, but are you everything that I want? And then next question would be, God is everything you need, but do I even really believe that? Do I even really believe that? And remember, actions speak louder than words. So if you want to know your belief, look at your actions. I have a theory that I've been thinking about lately. I think luxury can deaden our longings. Right? Luxuries can deaden our longings, especially for God. They can distract us from our true needs. And I kind of had to giggle and laugh a little when I was thinking of this next illustration, but and you'll know why in a little. Anyone remember when you drove someplace and you had to go on MapQuest and print out directions? Who remembers that? And I'm sitting there thinking, what a great illustration. Then I'm sitting there going, how many of the older people are going to say, yeah, well, we remember when we still had to pick up an atlas. And I went, oh, yeah, I just aged myself there thinking printing off of MapQuest is so old school. Right? So, but we don't do that anymore. Who? I'm not going to ask. Why not? Because if I want to go anywhere, I plug it in this thing, I go to Google Maps, and I say, give me directions. It gives me live, up-to-date, traffic-changing directions to get me there as fast as possible in the best route. So I don't even need MapQuest anymore. I don't need an atlas, right? Because I got this. I got my trusty cell phone. Maybe the thing that actually really is everything we think we need. But then I was thinking, more illustrations. How many of you out there have ever had something go wrong with your car? And nowadays, you can just YouTube anything you want, and you can fix or attempt to fix every problem. Who loves that, right? Like, YouTube is amazing. I often wonder, like, where do these people have the time to make all these videos? Because I've yet to be able to YouTube something and not find somebody doing a step-by-step explanation of how to do this. Well, we have these gauges going off in our Pilot, VSA and ABS, and so I'm Googling, like, what do I do about this? And someone says, oh, you just take a jumper wire and you stick it in from the 4-hole and the 9-hole in your little reader that exists for the real mechanics to put their scanners into your car. And they say, yeah, it's real simple. You just jump it and this and that. And so I tried that. And at one point, I thought we put it in the wrong two holes. So we put it in two other holes, which those ended up being the wrong two holes because something sparked, and now half of the stuff in Ginger's car doesn't work anymore. Right? But why would I need a mechanic when I have YouTube? I'm serious. This is our thought process. Why do you need to cook when you can just throw something in a microwave? Right? This is what luxury does for us. Until the luxury doesn't work. Right? And that's what happens. But what luxury is deadening your longing? That's really the question. What luxury is deadening your longing? Is it social media? Is it the cell phone? That you don't even need to have downtime anymore. You don't even need to be stuck to have to wrestle through things in your mind anymore because no matter where you are, as long as you have this, you can be anywhere you want to be. Chatting with whoever you want to be chatting with. Perusing whatever website you want to be on. Right? Maybe it's video games. Why look for adventure in the real world when I can just go in some great adventure in some really well-done, put-together game and feel like I've accomplished something. I don't need to accomplish any real things in the real world. I just did it all there. Right? Do we see how this works? Books, movies, comforts, whatever it is. What is yours that's deadening your longing for the one true God? The one true being who can truly be everything you need. Here's the thing, though. Our luxuries deaden our longings until they don't. That's when our luxuries fall short. That would ever be if you're ever using this thing for GPS and your phone dies because you ran out of battery. Then you go, well, what do I do now? And if you're like me, then you just drive around forever thinking you're going to be able to remember and find it, because we don't ever pull over and ask for directions. You don't have a phone, you can call anyone anyway, right? Or trying to fix your car, and it only makes it worse, right? Then what do? I find that when something bad happens, when we experience some kind of suffering, that in a strange way, it's actually where the grace of God is on full display, but the hardest for us to see. So think about it this way. Imagine life without hard times. Nothing ever went wrong in your life. Just try to imagine that. I know it's hard. Try to imagine it. Nothing ever goes wrong. Everything happens exactly as you want it. It's the perfect life. Nothing but ease. No problems with any relations, no problems with anything you ever buy. Your house never breaks down, never has things go wrong with it. Your car never breaks down, right? Like just straight A's on everything, success in every sport or anything you've ever done. Just think about that for a moment. How long do you think it would take before you stop thinking about God at all if life was that easy? We already know what it's like going through good times. How easily we can stray. How easily we can think, oh, I got this under control. I got this. I can do this all in my own power. Imagine if your entire life was that way. I'll be honest, I don't think I'd be thinking about God much. Why would I? What would I need to? Maybe we'd say, oh, because you're gracious and you want to be thankful. And yeah, okay, but after a while, how long before our little minds of ours would convince us that there really isn't even a God and it's just all us making all this happen? So perhaps those toughest times in life are actually God's grace drawing us to the one who is everything we truly need. So I don't know what all of us are going through at the moment. I know what some of us are going through. I know what I'm walking in the moment. Maybe I can see it as God's grace saying, it's okay to not be in control. It's okay to be weak and not be able to take care of this because I am that person. I am that one who will be everything you need in the moment you need it. He proved it by coming in the flesh, living a perfect life, thus overcoming sin, dying on a cross, raising from the grave, thus overcoming death. And he promises that those who trust him, who follow him, who seek him with all their hearts will do the same. And along the way, we'll be transformed into his likeness one degree at a time. So what's the result of your vision test this morning? Perhaps you're in the same boat as me. My vision needs some help. But over the next 7 weeks, we're going to be relooking at Jesus. We're going to be saturating ourselves in who he claimed to be and what difference it makes in our lives. But you don't need to wait for that. Don't wait for next Sunday. Get into his word. Spend time in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And let God reveal himself to you again and find out for yourself how he truly is everything that you need. Let's pray. God, it is one of the hardest things for us to confess, but whatever it is that we have going on in our lives, Lord, I'm here to say it on behalf of the people. We don't have it. We don't have the solution. We don't have the power within us to overcome. We don't have it. But God, we're so thankful that you do. And my prayer is that you would continue to reveal yourself to each of us in powerful, meaningful ways, those burning bush experiences, those Isaiah in your presence saying, ah, woe is me because we see you in your glory, Lord. Continue showing that to us as we seek you with all of our heart. And may we all be able to say, I might not have it, but the God I serve does. Lord, be glorified in Jesus' name. Amen.